So, first of all, the general Buddhist teaching on karma and rebirth. Here, there are two things to consider. Karma in general and karma in particular. Or, the general nature of karma as a law or principle and the specific workings of karma, the specific workings of that law or principle. And the latter, the specific workings, traditionally comprises a classification of karma from different points of view. Now, in the most general terms, karma is simply a form of the universal principle of conditionality. That is to say, it is the law of conditionality itself at work on a certain level, a certain plane of existence. From a point of view which we can loosely describe as philosophical, the law of conditionality is the fundamental principle of Buddhism. The law of conditionality, profound and important as it is stated very simply, almost bleakly. It simply says that whatever comes into existence, on whatsoever level, does so in dependence on conditions, and in the absence of those conditions, ceases to exist. This is all, really, that the principle of conditionality sets, all that it lays down. But it constitutes the very basis, the very foundation of Buddhism. And this particular principle, so formulated, so stated, is known technically as the principle or the teaching, the doctrine of praticca sammuppada. This is variously translated. It used to be rendered dependent origination. Dr. Konza renders it conditioned co-production, and Dr. Benimoto Borua renders it causal genesis. But different as they are, they all do justice to one or another aspect of the total meaning of this term. And it signifies, as I've said, simply arising of things in dependence on conditions, and non-arising when those conditions are absent. And simple as it is, I repeat that this constitutes the very foundation, if you like, the essence of Buddhism, from a point of view loosely described as philosophical. And this principle, this doctrine of conditionality, praticca sammuppada, made its appearance, its explicit appearance, quite early in the history of Buddhism. We know that Buddhism begins with the Buddha. We know that it begins with the Buddha's experience of enlightenment, which traditionally took place under what came to be known as the Bodhi tree, that Buddha Gaya, about 500 BC. And we know, or at least we gather from the scriptures, the records, the traditions, we know that that state of enlightenment which the Buddha attained, by virtue of which attainment he is known as the Buddha, the Enlightened One, is a state, in the first place, of absolute freedom from all mental conditionings, a state of ineffable peace and tranquility and bliss, and above all, a state of transcendental insight into the true nature of existence, so that existence itself, reality itself, was revealed to the Buddha, made known to the Buddha, if you like, assimilated by the Buddha in that experience of enlightenment or sambodhi. So this was a tremendous thing, this was a tremendous achievement, a tremendous discovery, this achievement of enlightenment, this discovery of truth, of reality, not just intellectually, but by way of direct vision, direct perception, direct experience. So the Buddha became totally transformed from an ordinary man, an unenlightened man, He became an extraordinary man, an enlightened man, a new species of being, one who was at one with the truth, who had comprehended reality in all its heights and in all its depths. And the Buddha himself, in a way, at first, was staggered by the incommensurability of his own experience, his own achievement. It seemed so tremendous, so overwhelming, that at first he pondered very deeply. He was doubtful whether he should make it known to the rest of humanity, make it known to anybody. He realized it was something quite extraordinary, quite out of the ordinary, something unprecedented, something unfathomable, something which people would not be able to appreciate. That even if he started talking about it, talking about his discovery, talking about the truth, talking about reality, even if he was able to convey something, to communicate something, even if he was able to come down to those lower levels on which ordinary men stood and talk to them about what he had experienced, what he had achieved, it would be very difficult for them to understand. They wouldn't be able to comprehend. There'd be nothing in their experience even remotely analogous to what he had experienced. So at first we are told the Buddha was inclined to remain silent and to enjoy the experience himself and not make any attempt to communicate the truth that he discovered to other living beings. But then we are told, then the legend proceeds, Brahma Sahampati appeared. Brahma Sahampati was a sort of deity, the ruler over many thousands of worlds, a sort of cosmic figure, if you like, far inferior to the Buddha, but nevertheless occupying quite a high place in the scheme of evolution, in the cosmos, according to ancient Indian traditions. He appeared in front of the Buddha, we are told, and pleaded with the Buddha, entreated the Buddha, to make known the truth that he had discovered, saying that there were a few at least whose eyes were only a little covered with dust, and for their sake, for their benefit at least, the Buddha should make known the truth that he had discovered. Now we can take this story, we can take this incident literally, or we can take it symbolically. It may be that the figure of Brahma Sahampati, the voice of Brahma Sahampati, rising within the depths of the Buddha's consciousness, represented something working, something functioning within the enlightened mind itself, represented as it were the voice of compassion, the Buddha's own compassion, awaking for the first time after his experience, his great experience of enlightenment. But be that as it may, whether it was an external cosmic figure, Brahma Sahampati, appearing in front of the newly enlightened Buddha, or whether it was in fact the voice of compassion sounding within the depths of his own heart, the Buddha, we are told, opened his divine eye. Opened his divine eye, his third eye, if you like, as it's sometimes called, a sort of supranormal power or faculty of vision, and he looked forth out over the whole world, and he saw the whole human race, the whole of humanity, and we are told he saw them just like a bed of lotus flowers. He saw that some of them were immersed in the world, just like lotus plants deep down in the water, even deep down in the mud, not rising above it. Some he saw were rising just a little above the waters of the world, just like some lotus flowers, just protruding a little bit above the waters of the lake. And a few he saw stood clear above the waters of the world, just like lotus flowers, perfectly free from the water, blooming in the sunlight way above the water. And these few were those whose eyes were covered by just a little dust. And for their sake, for their benefit, he determined that he would rise from his seat beneath the Bodhi tree and go forth amongst men and preach and proclaim the truth which he had discovered. chapter. Now, this story is interesting. This story is important because it contains a reference to this teaching, this truth of conditionality. Pratitya Samutpada. While the Buddha was still undecided whether to preach or not to preach, when he was reflecting, we are told this train of thought occurs to him that this truth which I have discovered, this truth to which I have attained, which I've realized, which I've seen for myself, is very deep, very subtle, going against the grain of the world, as it were, very remote, very delicate, abstruse. So, what's truth? And the Buddha himself answers his own question in this passage, and he says, the truth of universal conditionality, pratitya samutpada. This is the truth. Having realized which, he doubted whether other people would be able to comprehend it. So it's quite clear from this passage that, in philosophical terms at least, it's the realization of this truth of universal conditionality, pratitya samutpada, that constitutes the essence of the Buddha's enlightenment. And hence we describe it as the fundamental principle of Buddhism. There's another important reference only a few months after the enlightenment. It is in connection with the famous story of the conversion of Sariputra. The Buddha, during his early wandering days as an ascetic, had five disciples who attended him, looked after him, and who had faith in him because he practiced asceticism and self-torture. When he gave up asceticism and self-torture, when he started following the middle way and taking solid food, for instance, they left him in disgust. But after his enlightenment, he sought them out. He taught them. They were his first disciples after he became enlightened. They too became enlightened. And with others, whom also he taught, they went out in all directions, preaching and proclaiming the message of the Buddha. And one of them, one of the five, called Ashvajit, happens to meet a young Brahmin called Shariputra. Shariputra came from the area now called Bihar. And from his childhood he had a very dear, very close friend called Moggallana. And these two made a pact that they'd go in different directions, and whoever found a great enlightened teacher first would tell the other, and they'd both become his disciples. So Sariputra was wandering about, and he happens to meet Ashvajit, one of these five original disciples of the Buddha. And he was very much impressed by his appearance. He appeared bright, shining, tranquil, happy. So Sariputra approached, saluted Ashvajit, and he asked the question which people always do ask, even now in India, when they meet someone in this way, who is your teacher? In England, we ask about the weather. But in India, they ask, who is your teacher? So Ashvajit answered, my teacher is the Shakyamuni, the sage, the wise one of the Sakya tribe, the Buddha. And then Sariputra asked the second question, the second standard question, what does he teach? This is quite a crucial question. What does he teach? So Ashvajit said, I'm a beginner. I don't know much about the Dhamma, the teaching, the doctrine. But I can tell you in brief. And he recited a little Pali verse, only two lines, which has since become famous throughout the Buddhist world. He said, or maybe he chanted, or maybe he even sang, of all those things that proceed from a cause, the Tathagata, that is to say the Buddha, has explained the cause, and also its cessation. This is the teaching of the great ascetic. And we're told that when Sariputra heard this statement of the truth, he was so delighted, he was so impressed, he was so overwhelmed, that insight arose within him. He saw, he had a glimpse of the truth which the stanza embodied, and he attained the point of no return on the spot. Obviously the ground had been well prepared. So he at once accepted that teaching and went off to tell his friend he'd found the enlightened teacher, he'd found the Buddha. So this verse represents what we may describe as the credo of Buddhism. You find it all over the Buddhist world, all over the East. You find it in Tibet, China, Japan, Thailand, Ceylon. You find it everywhere, engraved on seals, on monuments, printed thousands of times on strips of paper and stuffed inside images. If anything is Buddhism, this is Buddhism. You might think it's rather dry, rather abstract, rather general, rather uninspiring. But Sariputra didn't find it uninspiring. If one really reflects upon it, if one thinks about it, meditates upon it, then one will see that it does indeed represent the basis and the foundation of Buddhism, this principle of conditionality, that things arise in dependence on conditions, and when those conditions are no longer there, they no longer arise.